This is a podcast from Consilio. We bring people together to create better places.
Hello and welcome to Better Places, the podcast from Consilio, where we talk about politics, planning and development from across the capital and beyond. We go straight to our guest interview today with Councillor Sharma Tatler, Deputy Leader, Cabinet Member for Finance, Resources and Reform and Cabinet Member for Regeneration, Planning and Growth in the London Borough of Bren.
Hi Sharma.
Hiya, you're right.
Yeah, we're going to pretend that we've just jumped on the call when actually we've been talking for the last 55 minutes putting the world,
to rights, because we always do that.
So we're actually sick of each other now. So we'll keep this brief. Thank you so much for joining us again. You are a regular guest on.
Yeah, people might be bored of my voice by now.
Never. thank you for giving up your time to come and join us today. Last time we caught up was at Labour Party conference in Liverpool at our Back the Builders rally, which was very well attended.
The room
was too hot. None of the windows opened.
Not enough alcohol either, I feel.
Not enough alcohol. But we take all of this on board, we move forward. But let's talk about conference first. It was, for me, disconcertingly optimistic based on sort of historical experience of conference. But what stood out for you?
Well, surprisingly, that was my second full conference. I'm not really a conference newbie. Yeah. My first full conference was 22, and this is my second full conference. The reason I feel really optimistic, and I can't obviously judge it from previous years because I've not been to conference before, but it felt, on the whole, that there was a feeling that we're preparing for government, which is we should be doing, and actually we should be offering a serious alternative. It felt very professional, which is, kind of that move away from the student politics elements of what we can all sometimes fall into. And also feeling like there's a genuine conversation about what policy offers are going to be very different and what sets us apart from the opposition, and how we're going to tackle some of the big systemic issues that we're going to be coming into if we're fortunate to become into government next year. And I think, in terms of this conversation, the sheer volume of housing fringes there were.
And you did all of them.
I think, 7 panels, 2 rallies, I think I did, which was, extraordinary. And I think it marks where the party have moved to in terms of housing, and how people are taking us seriously about having a conversation about what policy offer looks like when we talk about housing. And I think, and a real acknowledgement that housing is probably one of the primary ways of dealing with inequality and social injustice, and what a lot of us came into politics to do. So that really felt reassuring. I think the fact that Keir's speech was so heavily including elements of housing and what we're going to be doing, and not just social housing, which is a real marked difference, what we as a party have always talked about, and understanding that we are the party of aspiration and home ownership is part of that. And it was good to see a realization that there needs to be reform, not just money invested, but reform in legislation and policy, that how we can do that and work in partnership with landowners, with developers, with social housing providers, with local government, because we all have to be part of that picture. And we all have to have a conversation about the grey belt as well, which I do really like the phrase of, and making a grown-up conversation about stuff, because we can't keep going as we are.
Well, let's talk about that. So Keir outed himself as a proud YIMBY, which, was very on brand for us. I think he pulled lines from our Back the Builders rally. But from what you heard around sort of policy announcements, and, I think sometimes people will be critical and say that there isn't enough meat on the policy bones. But in reality, we're probably at least a year out from an election. I suspect the Conservatives will want to leave it as long as possible based on current polling. But from what you heard in terms of policy, do you feel like Labour has grasped the scale of the challenge facing sort of housing and development sectors?
I think so. I absolutely think that. And I think, yes, I think there'll be some detail that we're still waiting for, which I think is understandable considering how far out of an election we are in the reality going to be in. But I do like the conversation about understanding what land use is going to be about. Like, we have to have a conversation about the green belt and what land use we're talking about infrastructure and industry and the links between the two, which is important. I think the framework's there. I think talking about planning reform, hugely important. And it's not suggesting that I don't think this is, well, I know Keir used the phrase bulldoze, but I think there's an element of understanding what needs to change in the planning system to make it more reflective of what our needs are. You know, and an understanding that there needs to be a community-led approach to some of these things. So where does a community voice come into the planning system and the built environment? So I think I'm really assured by that. I think what I'd love to see coming forward now is what does that look like? So if I was, you know, in the Shadow DLUHC team, and particularly in housing and planning, I'd be looking at things like, well, what are the current barriers in planning? And speak to planners. You know, my planning team in Brent, they want to see come things forward. One of the reasons they choose to work in Brent is because they know things get built here.
Yeah.
So what works in the current system, and what needs to be made more flexible, and what can we learn? And one of the things that's really that my planners talk to me about is that we need to streamline some of the policies. You know, in any one, particularly in London, like in any one place, you could have four levels of heavy policy that a developer or an applicant has to follow. So yeah. It's things like you've got the NPPF at the national level, then London plan, then local plan, then potentially an SPD or a neighbourhood plan. And, you know, all of them are great, but actually, is that too much? Are we talking about, like, it's really, really heavy. So I'd love to see a conversation around that, about how we potentially, if an application meets policy, how then does it, contrary to other elements of local government, if something meets policy operationally, it's approved and gone. Mm-hmm. Why does planning need another level of approval needed if it meets a policy? An application should be given the presumption of approval. You know, if there are things that need to be kind of scrutinized further, fair enough. But if it meets policy, don't wait for things to take too long time. And I think there's an element of things that you could do that can make things easier. So public borrowing needs to be paused and made cheap. You know, councils want to build. Councils like Brent, we want to build, and we're having to pause some of our schemes for the first time, which I hate doing. But we financially can't cope with numbers at the moment. And so there needs to be an element of how we can make public borrowing better so we can kickstart house building. And also, you know, on a wider point, and I think Angela referred to it, I think Nestle did, who's the chair of the leader of the LGA Labour Group, we need to resource local government properly. You know, 1 in 10 county councils are on the brink of bankruptcy. We've got London councils are saying that in London there's a 500 million shortfall because of temporary accommodation this mm-hmm. year alone. Like, and that's cross-party. So we need to make sure local government is standing, and not just do it, you know, council by council, but look at whole scale. Where does the funding, where are resources needed?
I think you just touched on it about that sort of collaborative approach, both between sort of local authorities and developers, but also with communities. And I'm acutely aware that I'm biased because Brent's my favourite borough and I used to work there. But
do you
think Brent is an example of what the next Labour government should be doing in terms of, I mean, you look at how much Brent has changed over the last 10, 15 years mm-hmm. in terms of, you only have to step off the train at Wembley and see what's been delivered, the inward investment, the transformation that's taken place. And you've taken the communities with you. It's inclusive, and you know there is participation in that development, and existing residents are benefiting as much as new residents. Is that a model you think that nationally Labour could learn from?
Absolutely. You know, and it hasn't been easy. I won't lie. I carry the scars of some of the difficult conversations that we've had to have. And I've been very lucky that actually the steer and direction that we have as Labour administration, our offices have completely bought into. And we've transformed our planning service, our regeneration service, our housing service to enable us to kind of make sure that we can realise those ambitions. And it all starts with about life chances. And so everyone is bought into, if we're able to deliver what we want to deliver on our local plan, then life chances of our residents will be better. And so there is an element of pride in that. You know, and it hasn't come with that difficulties. We use the levers that we've got already. So things like the community infrastructure levy, the neighbourhood portion, we make sure that it's really heavily community involved, that people know it's from regeneration and they can see the benefits. So even parts of the borough where there isn't much regeneration, they still benefit from the massive stuff that's happening in Wembley or Kilburn or, you know, in other parts of the borough where we've got big development taking place. So it's important that we connect those with those communities. And also understanding where community voice is most useful and, you know, productive. So we're very keen to make sure that community voice is very strong in the policymaking stage. So, you know, we did that in our local plan. We've done that in our area master plans that we've adopted recently in Church End, in Neasden. We're doing that in Staples Corner, which is a brownfield site that's borders Barnet. And we're currently consulting on the design code. We're going to be enacting and working with the community on a master plan, which it's mainly an industrial site currently, but we're working with local businesses and with local communities about how we can transform the area to have industrial capacity, but also residential, and to change the nature of Staples Corner. So it's doing that, but it's also seeing, you know, understanding that the community want a say in how things look and feel. So, you know, we've had in place a design review panel for applications that come forward. We're currently embarking and taking applications from residents to create a community review panel. So there's going to be about a dozen or so people from that are cross-section of residents from the borough, including young people. So we've got an element of 16 to 18 year olds who are going to be part of this monthly review panel that will see and examine planning applications, looking at design and what, you know, what can contribute to a better application for the borough. And so the community voice, you know, led by somebody who's experienced and knows the process, but there'll be a panel of 12 to 15 people who are a cross-section of Brent's community, and they will be inputting.
They've got one in, we're doing some work in Newham in the LLDC, and they've got one fairly recently formed, and it's brilliant. You get a really different, you know, for all of the benefits of dealing with sort of people who are specialists in planning and design and development, you get so much more information from people who just live and work in the communities, who, you know, understand the specific challenges or where the opportunities are for development, and really often really small tweaks and changes to proposals that make a massive difference, just because you're able to talk to the people who live there and have those conversations and talk through maybe some of the restrictions of the site, but equally just invite them to talk about, you know, wider challenges or opportunities in the area. It's such a useful resource.
Yeah, and I think it's also about making sure that communities feel that regeneration or development isn't done to them, but with them.
Yeah.
And this is something that I think often is often an object or obstacle for schemes, is that people feel that they've had no say in how the environment's changing. And I get that argument to a point that it can be quite scary if you think, you know, if the world that you inhibit is changing quickly and dramatically, but actually trying to get them ownership into it and seeing what the opportunities can bring about a better scheme or better policy. But I think there's also an element of what we do in Brent is saying, actually, yes, we will hear objections. Yes, we will, you know, do mitigations to a point. But our strategic objective here is that we need housing, you know, and developers know that too. We're very clear about what we want, and we make those partnerships work in the sense that we're very clear what our red lines are, and they've got to meet them. And in most, 9 times out of 10, they do meet them. And that means we've been able to get the highest new homes bonus this year in the country. We're one of the leading boroughs in providing social housing in London. And we've persistently been one of the boroughs in our housing delivery test that's always exceeded our targets. So it can be done if you're willing to have these difficult conversations and show a little bit of leadership, saying, actually, it's hard now in those first few weeks of a planning application, but it will quieten down because people will end up seeing the benefits, seeing more people, you know, come through. What I think could help us further is if public sector partners were resourced or had the capacity to make sure that they deliver what they need to deliver alongside them, whether it's a medical school, medical centre, particularly the sort of NHS, or transport. Like, you know, there's TfL are very, very under-resourced, not under-resourced, but they are very stretched. And we need lifts in stations, for example, or we need better bus routes, you know, things like that that will make infrastructure better. So there's conversations around that, I think. But Brent is somewhere that I do feel that I think we've pushed as far as we can in terms of the current frameworks and what levers we have. So as a starting point, I'd love to see Labour look at what we do.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, you just touched on it then, but I think you could talk to anyone in local government and from a development and planning perspective. And the number one ask anywhere, certainly in London, and I imagine further afield, is housing. Like, residential development is the single product that local authorities want above anything else, because there is such a shortage. We were talking before about the pressures that sort of temporary and emergency accommodation budgets are put under now, as more and more people who, you know, 12, 18 months ago were in the private rented sector and doing okay are now seeing rents, you know, increase by 25, 30, 40%. And are really struggling and are looking to the local authority, understandably, to help. But that puts your finances under enormous pressure. Is it a real challenge for you and Brent, sort of bringing forward residential development in the borough and delivering those houses? Are you finding that it's a more difficult environment than it's been in the last few years?
I've not seen it as bad as this. I've been in the brief nearly 8 years now.
Have you really? And God.
Yeah. No, seven. Yeah, just over 7 years. 2016. So yeah, I've been around the block.
How many prime ministers is that? Hold on.
I think I'm the longest serving Regen lead in London, I think, potentially, apart from Darren Rodwell, potentially. But, you know, Darren won't let it go. It's not, from the conversations I've had with developers, if we don't give permissions in time, the finances mean that they can't deliver. People are spending millions on just the designs and getting things sorted. In our own schemes, we've had to pause because the numbers just don't work. One scheme is going to cost us, we've got a £9 million gap. We've had to pause some of our other schemes. You know, it's incredibly frustrating because often these schemes are in the places where housing is actually the most acute need. Mm-hmm. And if I give you sort of a context, so last summer, we were getting a handful of people coming to us every week, you know, declaring themselves homeless. And obviously we've got a legal obligation to make sure they're housed. We're getting 148 to 150 applications a week now of people declaring themselves homeless who previously were okay in the private rented sector, but we obviously have an obligation to make sure that they're housed. Having to send people for the first time in my time as a lead member outside of Brent in hotels and B&Bs, which again is mounting the cost for us because housing subsidy can only stretch so far. And it's going to cost on our budget an extra £13 million this year, temporary accommodation alone. We have no flex to absorb that sort of thing. So we're having to put expenditure controls into the organisation for the first time to help manage the budget, because we don't want to get into a point where we don't have the finances to do that. And that in itself means that other services struggle. Other ambitions that we want to do, like climate emergency, for example, it's all about funding and what we can do, but there is no money. So it's the picture, I have not seen as bleak as this. And then we talk to developers, workforce is in there. You know, Brexit meant that lots of workforce left the sector. Construction costs are astronomical. Plasterboard is, like, you know, four times what it was than it was 2-3 years ago. Like, how is that sustainable? Yeah. So it's a really, really grim picture. And I unless there's a concerted effort from government, from the private sector, from us about how we meet those challenges, I don't know how this gets better.
So one thing, a trend that we've seen over the last couple of months has been a real shift away from purely residential schemes to, I guess, non-traditional housing products. Things like, well, either purpose-built student accommodation or the sort of co-living apart hotel serviced apartments model. And particularly on the latter, I don't think anyone, certainly I'm not, entirely clear what that product is in terms of whether it's one type of offer or whether it varies from sort of location to location and product to product. But is that something you're seeing more of, Brent? Is it something you see as playing a part in tackling that wider housing crisis? Or is it, you know, from your perspective, almost problematic that that product is coming forward perhaps in place of residential? Because presumably there is a viability reason for that those are being brought forward rather than straight up residential. Is that something you're seeing as a local authority? Are you aware of it? Do you empathise with developers who are having to look at that model, or would you push back as a local authority?
Well, I mean, I think, I mean, if I take student housing, for example, I absolutely see the need. I want to see younger people in the borough and want to see them working here, contributing here. I suppose the tension is student housing doesn't mean that we get council tax, if I'm being really crude about that.
So we
can't charge council tax on student housing. But I can see the argument that rather than having five students in a house where we could be for a family unit, put them in student housing. Mm-hmm. The co-living product, I'm still a little unsure about as to who it's supposed to target and what it's supposed to alleviate. Mm-hmm. I understand the returns are probably better for a studio type, you know, co-living product for a developer, and with the current market as it is, I can see why for them it may work. But for us as a council and local authority, our need are family units. Mm-hmm. So we constantly have the tension of, well, you know, we need family units. We don't need, you know, co-living products, which, you know, in many times I've seen them basically essentially be an upgrade of student accommodation, which is, you know, if that's what people want, great. But I'm not convinced. I've not seen enough data or understanding or quantifying what that's supposed to alleviate or do. Mm-hmm. And for sometimes for what it is, it can be quite expensive compared to a house. So I need to be more convinced. I mean, and I know some authorities have got a specific SPDs around co-living. We still use the sort of London plan basis as our policy requirements. And some are great. And some in some locations I can see it working, but I still would need to understand how it contributes to the living element of, or the community aspect of a development. Because it can't, you know, even our conversations with Resi, what does that mean for the area? Like, how, if it's just Resi, then you're not creating a community, you're not creating a place, are you? You're not actually placemaking. So when we talk to developers about residential, we also talk about other things, workspace, retail space, you know, it's infrastructure. So all of that contributing to that, I'm still a bit skeptical on it. If you're talking about Wembley, if people can't do residential, I'd say do a straight up hotel. If you're looking at numbers and viability, you know, we're getting more and more events at the stadium, more arenas, you know, full pelt now. So where more and more people want to come and stay in a hotel in Wembley. So if residential doesn't work, then do a normal hotel.
You know, actually talking about Wembley, you know, which is certainly from my perspective, the jewel in the development crown of Brent in terms of the investment that's gone in there, the change. When you walk down from the station now and you've got Box Park and, you know, you've got the retail park up by to the west of the stadium and all of the residential that's come up around there as well. It's just transformed. Mm. What's the next step for Wembley? What's the next piece for that? Or are you done there now and you're moving on?
Well, no, I think the residential seems to be taking care of itself. And actually, when you speak to the developer or PERS now, because there's more than one developer in around Wembley, the residential element is actually quite full. They're able to fill residential from international students right down to downsizers and so on. So, and it's really multicultural in that regard. And it's a young feel. Like when you come into the, when you walk through Olympic Way to the Civic Centre, on an 8:30 on a Wednesday morning, it is buzzing already because you've hundreds of people to and from the station.
Yeah.
So that's great. But what I'd want to see for Wembley is the more cultural offer. So, you know, Wembley shouldn't just be just football and the stadium. Like, what else can Wembley offer? And it's great that we've got the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra now based in Wembley. The head office is there. So they're putting in a program of events through the year, which is fantastic. You know, we're getting more and more sort of office and kind of community elements, community spaces all around. We've got pop-up theatre coming. Like, we want to see more of that cultural aspect of it to make a place a destination, not just a football stadium and not just residential. So that's the next phase for, in my mind, for Wembley. But on a wider scale for Brent, our local plan has now that we adopted last year, has identified several areas that we want to see come forward. So adopted SPDs for Neasden, for Church End, for Edgware Road, Northwick Park, the One Public Estate, is now sort of under construction. Mm-hmm. South Kilburn is moving to a single delivery partner model. So there are other opportunities that we want to see, maybe not to the scale of investment for Wembley, but certainly kind of that injection of investment that transforms an area. And we're seeing that in Neasden. We're getting some great applications coming forward for Neasden now. Church End is now starting to move, Harlesden. And, you know, and these are areas that have been chronically underfunded or underinvested for decades. And actually, what's great to see is the investment come in, but also a feeling that we want to make sure that the communities and what's great about those places stay unique. So, you know, that's what coming forward. And South Kilburn, when it first started, no one wanted to touch it. No developer wanted to look at South Kilburn. And we've taken we took the decision that we're going to lead on it. And now it's so favorite, people were so interested in it that we were able to now go for a single delivery partner as opposed to phase by phase contracting out to a different developer. And so we have had so much interest already about, well, we want to be part of the single delivery conversation.
So let's talk about South Kilburn, because it is at the end of my road. And for anyone who doesn't know sort of what's going on there, I guess, A, if you can explain a little bit about what it is and how that model's worked and sort of the JV approach. But it's phenomenal in terms of what's been delivered there. And I think the first phase was Countryside, I think I want to say.
No, L&Q back 10 years ago, yeah.
Oh, okay, so which stage was Countryside? In fact, rather than me piecemealing it, why don't you explain a little bit about what that is, how the model works?
So South Kilburn began from the New Deals for Communities sort of program years ago. And the master plan funded, we had money to fund the master plan and some elements of community about how we go about it. And at that time, lots of estate regenerations were being planned, but what we went out to the market and we couldn't find one developer that wanted to take on the whole scheme. So we master planned and we obviously broke it up by phase. And one of the sort of key elements of South Kilburn's estate regeneration is that we don't do a double decant. So you don't decant residents off and then come back again somewhere else. It's one decant and that's it. So people move from the old to the new. So it's why it takes a little bit longer than standard estate regen scheme. So we build new and then move forward. So the first phase was done by L&Q years back, which was probably the most lucrative bit, which is by Queen's Park Station.
Yeah.
And actually we've got a Marks and Spencers on the ground floor of one of the developments. They're making 3 or 4 times more than they ever projected to. So
most of that is me, to be honest.
and it's the right location for that sort of retail there. So it's really worked. But what we've done since is actually every phase coming forward, we then we design it. So we procure the architect design team. We then obviously go out to consult, go and work with the communities about that. And then great through planning, and then we go out to procure for a development partner, and then with the development partner there will be negotiations about grant, about who the registered provider will be for the social housing element of it, because we're doubling the density from 1,200 to 2,500 to 3,000 homes on the estate. And a few of the things that we've secured in the master plan is a brand new medical centre, which is currently being built by Countryside. A primary school so we've got two primaries in infant and junior that we're going to be working with to create a brand new primary school, actually the bottom of your road at the end of Carton Vale.
Yeah.
and other community facilities throughout the estate, including a civic space where we can have a market square. We've got a social enterprise hub, a community kitchen, and all that kind of element that we want, potentially a gym as well at some point. So all that's coming forward, and we've done it phase by phase because previously no developer wanted to take on the whole scheme entirely. Mm-hmm. We're now at the stage where actually we soft market tested. I should also say, in the middle of the scheme, we did an estate regeneration ballot. And at the time, it was London's biggest estate regeneration ballot. I didn't sleep for the best part of 6 months because I was campaigning kind of to get the yes vote. And we had a big turnout, over 80% turnout, over 80% said yes for us to continue. The main comment was, can you just get on with it and move faster? Like, we want our homes, you know. Yeah. We've designed new parks, like new green spaces have been designed in thinking about not just young children, but older young people, so like teenagers and so on. Mm-hmm. And so now we're at the stage where we soft market tested an approach around a single delivery partner for the rest of the phases. We've got about three or four phases left, or probably four or five phases, I should say, that include Queen's Park, Cullen House, so we've got an old place there, other parts of the estate, which I can't wait to demolish because the blocks are, you know, we want some new blocks, new great design. Yeah. And we are having our hand bitten off almost to say, we want to be your single delivery partner for this, for this. And from names of developers that we would never expected to come out to us before. And so that's what's really making it. I'm really proud of that fact, actually, that we've got people that are known for quality, known for good building. And it's the kind of angle that we want to pursue. So my message to any developer who's listening, if you want to be a single delivery partner for us, few things you need to make sure of: quality of design and how you work with our communities. They will be the two things, and how much affordable social housing you're going to give us. But they'll be the three things that I will particularly be absolutely looking out for, is the quality of design. I mean, we've had schemes on the estate that have won prestigious design awards, and we want that to continue.
It's unbelievable. When you walk down, so you know, you all know the Carlton Tavern, the pub that got knocked down without planning approval and then had to get rebuilt. So
that wasn't us, by the way, can I just say?
Yeah, it wasn't you. But it's, so a good friend of mine is the landlord there. So I probably more often than I should, actually, I should stop eating Percy Pigs from M&S and stop going to the pub. But walking down Carlton Vale, it is incredible, not only to see what's been built, but when you see the blocks that are now completely decanted, like the state that they're in, it really contrasts with what's been delivered. And some of those developments, so some of those ones that are now occupied, are of such a high standard. And, you know, it's an incredible sort of example of what can be delivered working with local authorities with that sort of model.
Yeah, completely. And it's not to say everything's perfect, and there'll be, you know, we have to have conversations with developers and RPs who, you know, sometimes need to be better at how they communicate with residents. But, you know, we say to them, actually, you know, if the numbers work, we will be your preferred RP. We will be, you know, we want to be the landlord, continue to be the landlord there. But it is that partnership working. And my premise has always been, and my focus priority has always been, just because you're social housing tenants in Kilburn does not mean that you deserve any less quality of housing than your neighbours who live across the road in multi-million pound townhouses. Why should that, you know, your children both go to the same schools? You know, that's how you get social mobility and kind of life chances improved. You know, I met a family who had been living in temporary accommodation for the best part of 10 years. They were in two bedrooms, three boys. The eldest son is disabled, so he had to have his own room. And the parents were sharing a bedroom with their two younger boys for the best part of a decade. And we were able to provide them a home where the parents had their own bedroom for the first time. The older son had his own room. The boys all had space to do their homework, and it was secure housing. And they were just like, I cannot tell you. They were like, I got a hug from the mom saying, thank you so much. You've changed our lives. And that's who we do it for. For all the objections that we get, for all the noise that I will always get from NIMBYs, from people who don't like quote unquote regeneration and talk about refurb over demolition, my argument will always be, I will sleep easy at night, every night, knowing that the work that we're doing provides those families with opportunity and a better life. You know, I grew up on a council estate. I know what it means to have a good home and not have a good home. And as a Labour administration, if we're not doing that, we are not doing our duty as Labour politicians.
What an uplifting note to end it on. Right, I know for everyone else, we've only been talking for about 25 minutes, but we've now been on this call for about close to 2 hours, and it's enough, to be honest. Sharma, thank you so much for joining us.
No, it's been great. Thanks, Luke.
All right, come and see you in Brent soon.
Take care. Bye. Bye.
Well, that's it from us. Thanks for listening to another episode of Better Places. Don't forget to like and subscribe on all major podcast platforms, and we'll speak to you soon. Thanks very much. Bye, 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 bye.